Well, we already made it all the way through the process. The process being the complete oxidation of glucose. Because I ended last time with the final big burst of ATP production that's involved in cellular respiration. So the slide we're starting with now, 19, is really just a summary of what we've already learned. Specifically, what is being shown here? What part of the overall process is this? Yes, this is oxidative phosphorylation, as you can see, which consists of two parts, electron transport and chemiosmosis. And we looked at separate slides for each of those at the end last time. That's where we left off. But now you can see all of this stuff embedded in the inner mitochondrial membrane. And there's many, many copies of this electron transport chain. There's many, many copies of this ATP synthase, all present in the same membrane. But up to this point, the energy that was originally in glucose has gone different paths, in a sense, or it's different things have happened to that energy. Some, of course, has been wasted as heat at many different places along the way. That's gone. Some of it is already now in the form of ATP, right? Because you've made some ATP by substrate level phosphorylation in glycolysis and also in the citric acid cycle. That's valuable stuff. But by far the biggest fraction of the usable energy that was originally in the glucose up to this point was in the form of reduced coenzymes. Because you produced some NADH and H+ in glycolysis. You produced some NADH and H+ in the oxidative decarboxylation of pyruvate. You produced even more NADH and H+ in the citric acid cycle. Plus, you produced some FADH2 in the citric acid cycle. All of those various full taxis combined are carrying most of the energy that was in the glucose. And that's where we are before this final part of cellular respiration, which is oxidative phosphorylation. The reduced coenzymes are the full taxis. They're carrying the energy. But they don't keep the energy, right? Like taxis, they drop it off. And the places they drop it off are the many copies of the electron transport chain, one of which we see right here. NADH drops its electrons off at complex 1 of the chain. FADH2 drops it off at complex 2. But they both kinds of taxis drop their electrons off at the chains. Okay, so when the electrons get delivered by the taxis, when the taxis get emptied, in other words, the taxis are no longer carrying energy. You're already past the citric acid cycle, so there is no more fuel left. And when the electrons get dropped off, then you no longer have energy in the form of full taxis, because the taxis have been emptied. And there is no ATP produced in electron transport. So where is the energy now?
Gradient.
Gradient of what? Well, I mean,
of the electrons, protons?
Protons, yes, a proton gradient. That's where the energy gets stored now. It was stored in the form of reduced coenzymes. Right? Originally it was in glucose, then it was stored in reduced coenzymes. Now, after electron transport, it's stored in the form of a proton gradient that's created by the fact that three of these complexes, 1, 3, and 4, are able to use the energy released by the electrons being transferred to pump protons. So those are both of the parts that got taken from the fuel, right? Electrons and protons. We dehydrogenated the fuel. Each hydrogen is an electron and a proton. They both ride in the taxis. The taxis dump them off, but the electrons get transported from member to member. That releases energy, and that energy gets used to pump the other kind of particle, the protons, from one side of this membrane to the other. This is the inner mitochondrial membrane, and it separates the matrix, one compartment, from the intermembrane space, another compartment. And the pumps that are also members of the chain operate to pump the protons from the matrix to the intermembrane space, thereby creating a proton gradient. And that proton gradient, like any gradient, is a source of energy. It's stored energy, right? So at that moment, the usable energy that was originally in glucose is now in the form of that proton gradient. No ATP is produced in this part, though, electron transport chain itself. But now that you have the gradient, that is a tendency for those particles, those hydrogen ions or protons, to diffuse down that gradient, right? The protons, having been pumped from the matrix to the intermembrane space, would like to go back to the matrix, because that's where they're in lower concentration, in the matrix. They want to go back. And they don't care how they get there, but they can't go directly through the phospholipid bilayer very easily because protons are positively charged, and they don't want to be around these hydrophobic tails that aren't polar at all. So the only places that they're able to get through are the many copies of ATP synthase embedded in the same membrane. Those are the little turnstiles that allow the protons to diffuse passively back into the matrix. But when that happens, that diffusion turns the rotor of the ATP synthase, deforming the catalytic knob, causing it to operate as an enzyme, which allows it to stick an inorganic phosphate from solution onto an ADP molecule to produce an ATP molecule. That's oxidative phosphorylation. I mean, that's the phosphorylation part of the phrase oxidative phosphorylation. What makes it oxidative is because the electron transport chain before that is a series of redox reactions. All right? But the part that is just the phosphorylation is chemiosmosis. The osmosis here refers to the diffusion of protons, even though it has nothing to do with the solvent. It's kind of confusing. But that's what it is. It's diffusion of a chemical, specifically protons. And you wouldn't have that if it weren't for the gradient being in place, right? That's where the electrons that have been accumulating in these taxis finally pay off. By being transported to each member of the chain, they get a little lower in energy each passage, and that release of energy is what powers these three complexes to be pumps to establish that proton gradient, which then pays off in the form of a lot more ATP produced in this final part, this chemiosmosis part, compared to the ATP that was produced in glycolysis and the citric acid cycle. Okay, so that was a summary of just oxidative phosphorylation. 20 is a summary of the entire process, the complete oxidation of glucose. It looks very similar to the summary slide we started with before we looked at the particulars of this. Recall that glycolysis, which is part one of that whole process, does not occur in an organelle. It occurs out in the cytosol, inside the cell, but outside of the mitochondria. And keep in mind what the three inputs are to that. You have the fuel itself, which is glucose, as an input. You have ADP, which is going to be turned into ATP, right, as an input. And you have NAD+, oxidized coenzymes, that are required as an input, because to make this thing happen, you have to put those electrons that get taken away as hydrogens from the fuel, you have to put those somewhere. That's why you have to give it a taxi for glycolysis to work. Right? Those are the three inputs. The outputs are what's left of the glucose after it's been broken. That's 2-pyruvates, still valuable fuel. ADP got turned into ATP in the process, so ATP is an output. and that is part of the goal. And NAD plus gets reduced by receiving those hydrogens into NADH and H plus. Very valuable stuff, right? That's one of the several places where a taxi gets filled. If the cell is capable, it certainly is going to want to continue the process after glycolysis and deal with the still valuable pyruvate as fuel. That's what cellular respiration is. Part two of the overall process, but it can be broken into three parts. And the first part represented by this white arrow is what? First part of cellular respiration. As you look through your notes, I want to remind you that you can't use notes on the test. So you need to get yourself into the position of being able to answer these questions without looking it up. In other words, if you're looking at your notes, you're not ready for this test, which is the hardest one. Yeah. Well, what's the complete name of that? It is true that pyruvate gets broken down a little bit more, but that first part is called the oxidative decarboxylation of pyruvate. Now, the decarboxylation part of that word refers to the fact that you take a carbon and two oxygens off, you take a carboxyl off, which is why that first part of cellular respiration produces some CO2. That's part of the total waste, because CO2 is no longer usable as fuel, right? That's part of the... You eventually will make six CO2s, but you make two in that process, one from each of the two pyruvates that enter per glucose. But that's not the only thing that happens. It's carboxylation, but it's oxidative decarboxylation because it involves also the filling of another taxi. So this is another source of NADPH. The oxidative decarboxylation of pyruvate allows for NAD plus to be turned into NADPH and H plus. Very valuable stuff also. But that's a second source of reduced coenzyme. Glycolysis was the first. Okay? No ATP in that process, but when you decarboxylate the pyruvate, which has three carbons, you take one of those carbons off. So that leaves still fuel, still barely fuel, but two carbons are left from the original six-carbon skeleton. And what do we call what's left of the fuel at this point after you decarboxylate pyruvate? What is the two-carbon fuel?
Acetyl.
Right. Acetyl then gets picked up by coenzyme A, a separate kind of taxi that specializes in picking up acetyl. And when acetyl is riding in the taxi, we call the whole thing acetyl coenzyme A rather than just coenzyme A. And coenzyme A drives that two-carbon fuel to the next part of the process, the second part of cellular respiration, which is the citric acid cycle. And the citric acid cycle completes the dismantling of what's left of the fuel. So what's entering it is a two-carbon fuel, and what comes out of it are separate CO2s. And so you end up getting four CO2s, plus you already made two CO2s from the previous step. That's all six CO2s. And that's why the fuel no longer is there, right? You've turned the six-carbon glucose into six, energetically speaking, worthless CO2 molecules. But you haven't made nearly as much ATP as you could make from the energy. At this point... Well, another important thing that's happening besides this dismantling of the fuel in the citric acid cycle is that you reduce even more coenzyme. You make a bunch more NADH and H+, plus you make some FADH2. Notice those are coming out. And so you have three different places along the way where you fill taxis. Glycolysis, oxidative decarboxylation of pyruvate, and the citric acid cycle. Glycolysis and the citric acid cycle also make some ATP, but importantly, they make these reduced coenzymes. And all of these reduced coenzymes are really what are carrying the energy that's left that hasn't been wasted as heat or made into ATP already. The energy that was originally in glucose but has not yet been made into ATP or has not been wasted as heat is being carried by the taxis. And that gets us to the last part of cellular respiration, which is what the previous slide was. Oxidative phosphorylation. All of these taxis from these different places are driving to the electron transport chains and dumping those electrons off, electrons and protons. And that's what allows for the electrons to be transferred, powering the pumping of the protons, establishing the gradient. And when that happens, the energy that is still useful, but that has not yet been made into ATP, is in the form of the gradient itself. Because the taxis are then empty after they've dumped off their electrons. Okay? And then that proton gradient itself is what causes that final burst of ATP production. Okay, now let's go to 21, but before I get into the particulars of what's showing here, I want to talk about what happens in that final part of cellular respiration. Oxidative phosphorylation includes electron transport and chemiosmosis. What has to be true for that to continue? For electron transport to continue to happen, what has to be true? Well, the gradient of protons is produced because electrons are releasing energy to power the pumps. But what has to be, in order for that to happen, though, the electron transport itself, in order for that to continue, what has to be true? No, coenzymes are not picking them up, they're dropping them off. And what has to be true for them to continue to be able to drop them off? Or what would prevent them from dropping them off? All these taxis are full of energy. They want to drop the electrons off at the electron transport chains. What would be true that would prevent them from being able to do that? No, that's a good guess, but no.
The absence of oxygen?
Yes, and why? What's so special about oxygen?
Oxygen is oxygen.
Yeah, that's true. What does oxygen specifically do for us? It's actually damaging to our body, which is why we need antioxidants. But we also absolutely require it. Why do we have to breathe oxygen?
Do we have organic carbon?
No. The organic carbon comes from our food. That's why we're consumers. We can't make our own. What is the specific function of oxygen in this whole process? Which is almost the only reason you need oxygen. Water does get produced in the process, but what is oxygen doing? It is serving as the final electron acceptor. The answer I was looking for when I asked what has to be true for electron transport to be able to continue to happen is that something at the end of the chain has to be taking the electrons. Otherwise, the electrons are just going to fill up the chain, and that's when the coenzymes will be prevented from dumping any more onto the chains. The chains can't take any more on at the beginning unless you're continuously taking things off of the end. And that's what oxygen does. It's the final electron acceptor. And any respiring organism, any organism capable of cellular respiration, has to have a final electron acceptor. In most organisms that can undergo cellular respiration, that final electron acceptor is oxygen, just like it is for us. There are some organisms, though, that do basically the same thing, instead of using oxygen, though, they use something else that will take the electrons. They're still respiring, because the what qualifies it as respiration is the electron transport and the pumping of protons. So if you use oxygen as the final electron acceptor to do that, then your version of respiration is aerobic, requiring oxygen. That's what we animals do. But there are some organisms that use a different substance, and they're still undergoing cellular respiration. It's just considered anaerobic respiration. Okay? Really important, though, because without that final electron acceptor, not only will all the stuff downstream of that, which is where most of that ATP is produced in chemiosmosis, not only will that shut down, and why will it shut down, by the way? If you don't have a final electron acceptor, why does chemiosmosis shut down? The electron transport chains get full, and therefore they're no longer doing what? Right, they're no longer passing electrons, and therefore, what doesn't happen? Why are they transporting electrons? What's the utility of that? What about it? The electron transport chain doesn't make any ATP. What does it do? Why is it transporting the electrons? What's it doing directly with the energy? No. No ATP is produced in electron transport. We just said this about 5 minutes ago. What? Go ahead.
Chemiosmosis.
No, chemiosmosis is the part that relies on the answer to this question. But electron transport itself accomplishes what directly?
The pumping of the protons,
yes. That's where the energy from the electrons get used. So if you fill the chains up with electrons because they can't be emptied at the other end because you don't have oxygen, then you no longer are pumping any protons, right? If you no longer pump any protons, why does that cut off chemiosmosis? Let me temporarily go back to slide 20 so you can see the picture here. You shut down electron transport, actually, 19 would be even better. You shut down electron transport because it fills up, right? No more pumping of protons. Therefore, however much of a gradient you have at this moment is going to be dissipated because you no longer have pumping of protons. They're eventually just going to diffuse until you have equal concentrations on either side of the membrane. Without any tendency for hydrogen to keep diffusing, you no longer are turning the rotors of the ATP synthase. And therefore, you're not producing any more ATP. So, shutting down electron transport chains because you don't have a final electron acceptor, oxygen, is going to shut down all the downstream stuff, which is chemiosmosis. Is that clear so far? But it's also going to shut down upstream stuff. And if there weren't for a different process that we're just about to talk about, it would actually back up everything, including glycolysis. Glycolysis does not directly require oxygen. Okay? But what did I say the three inputs were?
Glucose,
ADP, and NAD+. Which of those would not be available if it weren't for oxygen? If oxygen is not present to take the electrons off the ends of the electron transport chains, which of those three inputs into glycolysis would you not have? Yes, because all of the taxis would be full, not able to dump their electrons off to the chains. Right? Eventually, the entire fleet, however many taxis there are, would all be full, And glycolysis requires empty taxis to pick up more hydrogens from the fuel. So even glycolysis would shut down if it weren't for the fact that there's a different mechanism that evolves for the purpose of oxidizing or reoxidizing NADH back into NAD+. If you have cellular respiration available because you do have oxygen as an acceptor, then you don't have the problem, right? Because NADH will get reoxidized into NAD+ simply by dropping the electrons off to electron transport chains. That's going to make them empty taxis again. They can go to glycolysis and allow it to continue as they pick up more hydrogens. But the moment you have no more oxygen available, all of this stuff will shut down, and glycolysis would accept that there is this alternative method organisms use to re-oxidize their coenzymes, and that alternative process, shown in slide 21, is fertilization. I'm sorry, fermentation. It has nothing to do with fertilization. Fermentation. Now, fermentation happens in different ways in different species. There are many different versions of fermentation. But nearly every biology textbook will tell you about just two, and there's only two shown here: alcohol fermentation and lactic acid fermentation. There's plenty of other examples. The reason that books focus on these two is that alcohol fermentation is economically important, industrially important. It's used to make alcohol for all the beverages that have alcohol. It's used in bread making, cheese making, all kinds of things. So it's important to us. And the other one is listed in most textbooks because this is this bottom one, lactic acid fermentation, is the kind of fermentation our own cells do. But any given species does one kind of fermentation only. It can't switch between. All right, now importantly, fermentation does not by itself produce any ATP. It's glycolysis that produces the ATP. Glycolysis requires empty taxis. When cellular respiration is also running, you have empty taxis because those taxis are dumping their electrons off to chains. But when you don't have cellular respiration, you have to somehow get empty taxis a different way, and that's what fermentation accomplishes. So fermentation doesn't produce the ATP, but it allows glycolysis to continue, and glycolysis produces ATP. Alcohol fermentation is kind of a two-step process. Of course, glycolysis produces pyruvate. We've already talked about this, a three-carbon compound. And in alcohol fermenters, like yeast, for instance, there's a decarboxylation step, so pyruvate gets decarboxylated into something that's called acetaldehyde, an intermediate, that then gets transformed into ethanol, the same alcohol that's in beer, wine, or spirits. Now, it's not that the yeast or whatever other kind of cell is an alcohol fermenter that is trying to get ethanol. In fact, it will be toxic if it builds up to too high a level, which is why you can only make wine a certain strength. If you want it any stronger than that, then you have to kill everything and distill it. But anyway, it's not trying to make ethanol. What it's trying to do is the thing that fermentation accomplishes in all cases, all versions, which is to reoxidize NADH back into NAD+. Fermentation gives the full taxi somewhere to dump those extra electrons. And that's in the step that transforms acetaldehyde into ethanol. So when we dupe the yeasts into working for us, notice, like brewing beer, not only is the beer alcoholic, but it's also carbonated because of this decarboxylation step, which is also why bread dough rises, because of the CO2 gas being released. Now, we can't do this version of fermentation. Otherwise, we would get drunk just by holding our breath. Right, because we would produce ethanol just by not breathing. Instead, it's kind of a more direct process in us. We don't have an intermediate. We take our pyruvate from glycolysis, and transform it into lactate or lactic acid, and that's what allows NADH to be reoxidized into NAD+, which allows glycolysis to continue. Lactic acid, though, is also a problem, and this is why you can't indefinitely sprint. You can jog more or less indefinitely until you eventually run out of stored energy in your body. But, you know, when you're jogging, your body is keeping up with the demand for oxygen, because your circulatory and respiratory systems are able to deliver oxygen as fast as it's needed by the working but not maximally working tissues of the body. When you sprint, though, if you were to do that entirely aerobically, you're requiring so much oxygen that it's beyond the capacity of your respiratory and circulatory systems to get that much oxygen to those muscles. So the cells will have to undergo fermentation instead, and lactic acid buildup is part of fatigue. Your body is not going to let you continue to sprint beyond a certain point. You just collapse. Okay, so 22 shows you that glycolysis has to happen for the cell to remain alive. Glycolysis has to happen whether there's an electron acceptor or not, whether oxygen is present or not. Right? If oxygen is present, though, then it will certainly be beneficial to the cell to take this road at the fork and go into cellular respiration. Use the oxygen as the acceptor, and that produces a hell of a lot more ATP, but it also allows glycolysis to continue, because part of cellular respiration involves the reoxidation of the taxis. If oxygen is not available, though, not only do you not get these rest of these ATP, but you have the problem of full taxis. And that's what fermentation will do. It will empty the taxis again, allowing glycolysis to occur. Doesn't produce any more ATP than what you already got from the glycolysis, but it allows you to continue to burn glucose to produce 2 more ATP per glucose. And the cell doesn't have to think about this, of course. It's not a conscious decision. It's automatic. If oxygen is present, then the chains will be able to take the electrons, and therefore the reduced coenzymes will be able to drop them off, and it will occur automatically. Fermentation will occur automatically if that's the only way for these reduced coenzymes to be reoxidized. They won't be able to drop them off at the chains, so they'll have to go through fermentation to do it. Okay, 23. Everything we've talked about, from glucose all the way to CO2, is illustrated in this central pathway. This is the central metabolic pathway: glycolysis and then cellular respiration. And glucose is the starting point because it's the master fuel, the fuel that's used most often in all cells, all species. But it's not the only possible fuel, obviously, right? As far as nutrient classes are concerned, you have proteins, carbohydrates, and fats as potential sources of energy, as fuels. Now, first, before you can use anything as a fuel, you have to digest it, which occurs outside of our body, right? You break these big things into the small chunks that can be used as fuel. So starch, for instance, a complex carbohydrate, a polysaccharide, you have to first digest that into the individual glucoses. Glucose, of course, can start right at the beginning of glycolysis, but there's also other monosaccharides. It's not the only monosaccharide. So when you break down the carbohydrates into individual monosaccharides, some of them are things other than glucose. Well, those other monosaccharides can be fed into a later part of glycolysis. There's many intermediates in the 10-step part of glycolysis, and that includes other monosaccharides that can be put into to a different part of glycolysis. Once you get it into a step, the cell can't tell whether that came from glucose or from some other source. When it comes to fats, remember, a fat is a triglyceride. That's still a big molecule. So the digestion of that that will turn it into potential fuels is to dismantle the four-part fat. Fat has four parts to it, right? One glycerol, and glycerol, once it's liberated by itself, can be fed into glycolysis as part of an intermediate in that process. And then you have three fatty acids also when you dismantle it. Well, think back to using glucose as the fuel. When we get to the part of transitioning from part one of cellular respiration to part two of cellular respiration, what is the fuel at that point? No, the fuel. Coenzymes are picking hydrogens off of the fuel along the way. But what is left at, what's the final fuel that's left right before part two of cellular respiration, which is the citric acid cycle? Right. An acetyl group is all that's left of the fuel. That's what gets picked up by coenzyme A, right? And an acetyl has two carbons in it and hydrogens. Well, think about what a fatty acid is. It's part of a fat. A fatty acid is a carboxyl group with a bunch of carbons and hydrogens, right? Most of the fatty acid is just a hydrocarbon tail. Well, if you use a fatty acid as a fuel, you don't use the fatty acid directly as a fuel. What you do is dismantle the fatty acid two carbons at a time. If you clip off two of the carbons, that's an acetyl. And you can put that onto coenzyme A, and the cell can't tell whether that came from glycolysis, from pyruvate, or from a fat that just feeds in at a different place. Now, those are the two major fuels, carbohydrates and fats. Proteins can also be a source of energy, but they're typically not really used as energy. You use proteins mostly for structures and for enzymes, and you know, all the various proteins in the body are built out of amino acids that you take in as proteins from whatever organism you ate. And so we recycle them all the time, basically. We really don't. It's problematic to take in too much protein, as a matter of fact. A lot of Americans don't realize this, and they overdose on proteins, and there's a link with cancer, actually, for doing that. But anyway, proteins can be used as fuel if they have to be. Like in starvation, of course they will, because all these other things will no longer be available. But first, of course, the protein itself isn't fuel. It has to be digested into smaller things that could be used as fuel, which are the amino acids the protein is made out of. Unlike carbohydrates and fats, which are made out of nothing but carbon, hydrogen, and oxygen, amino acids all have nitrogen in them, right? There's 20 different kinds, but they all have nitrogen in them. That's the amino part of amino acid. And that's a problem. If you're going to use this as fuel, you need to get rid of that nitrogen first. That's nitrogenous waste, which comes off as ammonia. And then we convert that. Different organisms do it different ways. We convert that then into urea, which is still toxic and just not as much as ammonia. And then we get rid of that in urine. But the rest, after you take the nitrogen away, is carbon, oxygen, and hydrogen. And that can be used as fuel. Depending on the amino acid, it gets fed into different parts of this central process. So we studied it from the viewpoint of glucose, which is all the way through it, but the other fuels can feed in at different places along the way. That's why it's called the central pathway. 24 shows you the same central pathway, but the new information here is the control of it. Keep in mind that there's all kinds of different pathways that any cell can perform, but no cell ever wants to be operating all of its possible pathways at the same time. That would be wasteful at least and fatal in most cases as well. So it's appropriate to run a pathway only when the product is needed. In other words, it's important to be able to control pathways. And we've talked about inhibition of pathways before. You see red inhibition arrows here. If the point is you don't want to run this central metabolic pathway at full bore all the time. You can be running it too fast, like if you're not really using much energy. So if citrate builds up, that tells the cell you need to cool it off, basically. Citrate comes back and interferes with an important control enzyme in glycolysis called phosphofructor kinase. And this is just another example of the one that I showed you for when I first told you about feedback inhibition, inhibiting. ATP itself inhibits. That should make sense to you, right? If you're making too much ATP, way more than you actually require at the moment, it's wasteful to do that. So you're burning fuel when you don't really have to. So ATP itself will also inhibit this. On the other hand, if you have a buildup of AMP, that means your ratio of empty taxis to full taxis is getting too high. Too many of your taxis are empty. Really, you shouldn't really call these taxis. Technically they are, but energy-carrying nucleotides is what AMP, ADP, and ATP are. And so when too big a fraction of your adenosine-based nucleotides is in the form of AMP, then that tells the body you're not producing ATP as fast as the body is demanding it. And so AMP is a strong stimulant. You could not only turns this on, but ramps it up quickly. And I think that's the chapter. Yeah, it is.